which of the many policy decisions that have been made, which of them do you think have actually affected, had real impact on how the convention has been implemented? There have been lots of policy decisions, big ones and small ones, and some of them, I think, have. I would say, as an example, I think the cultural landscape, the decision on the category of cultural landscapes is one that I think has had a major impact on how the convention has been implemented. Are there any that jump up in your mind?
Absolutely. This whole cultural landscape thing was of major importance because that is what really links the convention to sustainable development in many ways, right? And also, but then the hub, because I've been, you know, involved in cities for a good part of my career, I think the Hull recommendation, if it's done, if it goes to the next step of the application and the interpretation of the Hull recommendation, because right now it's just too vague for many people to understand. It's like the Venice Charter. People can interpret it into, you know, 10 different ways, and Hull recommendations also can be interpreted into 10 different ways. So this needs further work. But I think that once these different work aspects of the Hull recommendation takes on, then I think it could also become a very important instrument as well. But in the NARA declaration that we mentioned, that was absolutely, you know, humongous impact.
If you were going to give advice, how would you, in a way, operationalize the historic urban landscape recommendation?
Yeah, because right now there are academic studies on the, you know, application, you know, with, you know, these formats and whatever. I think that, you know, I think this is where it requires, I mean, the advancement in the theory is one thing, but you've got to apply them and to see its the force of its applicability. But this is why having it integrated more into the operational guidelines is important. It doesn't have the enforcement, you know, power of a convention, but by having it more mentioned in the operational guidelines, but before it actually goes into the operational guidelines, or even if, you know, simultaneously to it going into the operational guidelines, I think there has to be a lot more empirical application in order to inform how it can become a better text. You know, I mean, there could almost be an operational guideline for the application of the Hull recommendation in itself. That would be really interesting to work on. But you know, they're just still, the notion of integrity as applied to World Heritage culture site is still too vague. But I think also, as I said, the biggest importance of the World Heritage Convention is this thing of improving national standards. So when, you know, the team, you know, the UNESCO different regional teams was to come back from mission and say, wow, you know, we've managed to get a World Heritage Law. I said, ooh, wait a moment. Maybe that's not such a good thing, you know. Mentioning World Heritage within a national law is good. But then don't forget the whole idea of the convention, because the fact that the convention was adopted at the same time in the same year by the General Conference on the, you know, the recommendation for the protection of cultural and natural heritage of national importance was very important, because otherwise you're creating a double track system. In fact, the reality is there is a double track system even within, you know, countries in Europe, which gives a lot of importance to heritage. The World Heritage sites get priority funding from government. So that's why in many, many countries that actually don't need any more the international recognition because they already have it, they still want to put it on the World Heritage List because it puts them in a priority position of getting funding
in their own country.
But when I don't want you to misinterpret me what I said about the OUV, it is important that the OUV in whatever form is becomes a criteria for acceptance. But the statement of value, the statement of significance is done in a way that is not so quote unquote scientific. You know, because even in terms of the application of the criteria, it's not, you know, those of us who were involved in the early years, you know, we used to say, you know, with ICOMOS, well, okay, you know, maybe instead of using criteria, they, well, why don't we just use criteria four? You know what I mean? Like the change in the use of the criteria was pretty you know, done in not such an incredibly scientific way. So many sites merit recognition. So many sites merit to be protected. And if the world, putting it on the World Heritage List can help in the site protection, and if that creates the basis of, you know, uplifting or improving the national or regional, you know, conservation, you know, services, that's good. I mean, there's so many sites. You know, if you start looking at even the analysis of the World Heritage Cities sites, I mean, some of these places are absolutely not any better than anything else, you know, any other place that's not on the site. But I keep saying that doesn't matter. You know, what's on the list is on the list. So let's use every single site on the list as a tool to improve the overall national standards of conservation, and then ultimately with the whole sustainable development, you know, goals, right? I never wanted the World Heritage List to be a sort of an exclusive list. It has to be inclusive. And this process of the inclusiveness of the World Heritage Convention can only happen with the committee continuing to push for international solidarity action, and UNESCO, you know, using the convention also to improve the, you know, the conservation standards in the state parties.
You've mentioned a number of sites that have been important mm-hmm. in the evolution of the convention. Are there any others that you wanted to mention that have really, the decisions on specific sites that have really changed how the World Heritage Convention is implemented or how countries use the World Heritage Convention?
I think the Cologne Cathedral situation about the, you know, high-rises coming in behind the, you know, they actually, even if it was outside the buffer zone, but the fact that it made a visual impact, I think that was very important. Although it's, as I said, it created, it was in complete contradiction to what was already accepted in Korea, for example, you know. But at the same time, for a country like Europe with strong legislation and administrative management, you know, services to deal with it, it shouldn't have happened. You can't apply those same standards in a city that is like as dense as Tokyo, where, you know, like 80% of the population live in, 100% of the population, the majority of the population live in 20% of the land, you know, and even if for a tiny country the size of Japan, you know, so there has to be different things. But at the same time, I think high rises are not sustainable. This is why we have the UNESCO, as a whole, we have to take advantage of our universe. For teaching, as I said, ICROM can take the lead with university linkages. But for UNESCO, in terms of research, UNESCO is not a research body, but we should be asking the UNESCO chairs and the Category 2 centers and various groups of universities to do the kind of research that is really needed. We should really be making use of the global network that UNESCO has. And one thing that distinguish UNESCO from other UN agencies is our normative standard setting function, as well as our huge network of technicians. I mean, with the push of the button, UNESCO can find the top hydrologists in the world. You know, I mean, with the push of the button, you know, UNESCO can find the best cultural heritage specialists in brick construction or whatever, you know. I mean, we can do that thanks to our incredible intergovernmental network of expertise. But we should be putting that force of UNESCO together with the university network